Now, though, Jeffrey Richards tracks down the Robin Hood of crime in The Radio Detectives. Enter the Saint.
The Adventures of the Saint.
For most people, mention of the saint summons up images of Roger Moore, he of the quiff, the raised eyebrow, and the imperturbable suavity. From 1962 to 1969, he starred on television as Simon Templar, the saint. Each episode of the series began with a worldly and sardonic introduction, establishing Templar as the ultimate man about town.
A Persian poet once said, "A woman's eyes were all the jewels she needed." I'm afraid not many of the dowagers, divorcees, and wealthy widows who flocked to Cannes during the season seem to agree with him. Can you wonder the place is a magnet for every top crook in the business? They take time and trouble to select their victims, and each has his own way of operating.
After this, the saint would be off on an adventure that invariably involved stock footage of some exotic location, car chases against wobbly back projections, and much toing and froing around a handful of anonymous streets on the back lot at Elstree, which were continually redressed to make them represent London, Geneva, Saigon, or Marrakesh. But long before he became a star on British television, the saint had been a radio detective. Five different actors adopted the halo on the American airwaves between 1945 and 1951. And we shall look at these series later. But when the broadcast started, the saint was already well established as a fictional hero. He made his debut in 1928 in the novel Meet the Tiger.
The saint had travelled. He talked interestingly, if with a strong egotistical bias. He had won a gold rush in South Africa and lost his holdings in a poker game 24 hours later. He had run guns into China, whiskey into the United States, and perfume into England. He had deserted after a year in the Spanish Foreign Legion. He had worked his passage across the Atlantic as a steward, tramped across America, fought his way across Mexico during a free-for-all revolution, picked up a couple of £1,000 in the Argentine, and sailed home from Buenos Aires in a millionaire's suite to lose nearly all the fruit of his wanderings on Epsom Downs.
The novel was the work of a young writer called Leslie Charteris, whose own background was almost as exotic and romantic as that of his creation. Dick Fiddy is the co-author of a study of Leslie Charteris and the saint.
Charteris was raised in Singapore. His mother was English, his father was an Oriental, a doctor. Reputedly a very bright child, and at a very early age, 7 or 8, already interested in writing, had a typewriter and was already piling out stories of one type or another. And especially having come from Singapore and then back to London, he had already a flavour of the exotic. Leslie Yin was his original name, but he took upon himself to call himself Leslie Charteris. He took a fancy to Francis Charteris, a rake and adventurer, one of the founder members of the Hellfire Club, and I think that appealed to Charteris' swashbuckling imagination.
In his earlier stories, Charteris experimented with a variety of heroes, all very similar in style, before he settled on Simon Templar, and developed him in a series of stories for the newly launched Thriller magazine. The magazine's editor, Monty Hayden, encouraged and nurtured Charteris's talent, and was repaid by his inclusion in the stories as Templar's sidekick, Monty Haywood. Simon Templar, his surname inspired by the medieval order of crusading knights, was nicknamed the Saint because of his initials, ST, and his innocent appearance. He was a 20th century swashbuckler, an amalgam of Robin Hood, the original gentleman outlaw, A.J. Raffles and Arsène Lupin, the latter-day gentleman criminals, and the Scarlet Pimpernel, who concealed beneath a foppish exterior a brave and noble disposition.
And now it's home we're going, my darling, whether you like it or not. Bexy? Number 17, Juliet.
I suppose I should thank you.
Oh, don't thank me. You'll be retracting it sooner or later.
Why?
Because I am determined to make you hate me.
Are you crazy?
I wish you would invite me to your house sometime.
You might find a welcome that would surprise you.
Really? Well, in that case, I better tell you that my name is not Mr. Callahan. It is Simon Templar.
The saint.
The surname was chosen deliberately to reflect the chivalric ethos. One of the earliest novels was called Knight Templar, and in it Templar saved the life of the king, showing him to be, like Robin Hood, Raffles and the Pimpernel, a devout monarchist. This may help to explain why Queen Mary was one of the saint's most devoted fans. In a talk Charteris gave on the BBC's Empire Service in 1935, he outlined his conception of the character.
He wasn't, strictly speaking, a detective. That is, he wasn't exactly associated with the police, and he didn't want to be. And then again, he wasn't, strictly speaking, a criminal. Of course, he did a lot of unlawful things, and incidentally made money out of them, but there was always a suggestion of a good cause in the background, which made it seem so much more polite and gentlemanly. He was a real adventurer. My favourite proverb is a Mohammedan one, which I read somewhere. It says, "Paradise is under the shadow of a sword." I think that most men who've lived in danger will tell you that those were the times when they were most intensely alive. Something happens inside you which makes you realise that the rest of your life has been lived in a kind of fog. Contentment, safety, knowing just what's going to happen tomorrow. Those are the things that stupefy the brain. He believes in romance. He isn't merely going through the mechanical movements of a man in an exciting situation. He is, vitally and positively, squeezing the last drop of delight from living the best life he knows in the best way he can. And because of that, he is finding intensified delight in the more ordinary things around him. If I could feel that some of the people reading about him were infected, even in a lesser degree, with the same supreme excitement of living, I should feel I hadn't done a bad job.
The intensity of a life lived on the edge was counterpointed by the style, the sophisticated taste in cars, food and wine, the bantering humour, the air of world-weary languor. He was the quintessence of cool, and long before the term was invented, could justly be described as laid-back. Does Dick Fiddy think he was Charteris's fantasy projection of himself?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that probably happens with a lot of authors. He would deny it, as with other authors, but there's no doubt about it that the saint certainly shared some of Charteris's interest. Good food, world travel, etc.
All on your own, Eo, again?
Oh, hello.
Are you always being left alone?
Oh, the others are upstairs having a business conference or something. Where have you been all afternoon? You seem to vanish off the face of the globe.
Oh, about my business, just as you go about yours.
And what is my business?
Being friend Fairweather's tame vamp, I suppose.
You think I'm tame?
Let's see. What would be your fee for dining with a gent, say, Thursday?
That's the sort of dinner invitation no girl could resist.
Well, I fell passionately in love with you the moment I saw you.
I suppose I could endure dinner with you for a fee. After all, I've got to eat somewhere. Let me think. I couldn't let you off with a penny less than 50 guineas.
You know, there's an innocence, a freshness about you that's quite irresistible. Will a check do, or must it be cash?
Damn. I believe you'd have paid 100 if I'd asked. Oh, well, a bargain's a bargain.
Thursday, then, at 8, at the Barclay. And since this is a business deal, I shall expect you to be punctual. The fee will go down for every minute I'm kept waiting.
Charteris visited America in 1932, wrote The Saint in New York, and for the rest of the decade divided his time between Britain and the United States. During the war, he settled in America, becoming an American citizen in 1946. This change of country had a marked effect on the character and development of the saint. In his classic study, The Durable Desperados, William Vivian Butler detected 5 different saint incarnations. When he first appeared in Meet the Tiger, the character was romantic, piratical, and energetic. Then, during his appearances in the pages of The Thriller in the early 1930s, he mutated into the English gentleman adventurer, quixotic, laid-back, and equipped with a girlfriend, a circle of upper-class chums, and a Cockney valet, Oris. After 1934, an Anglo-American saint emerges, smoother, older, less flamboyant than before, and teamed with a Runyon-esque ex-gangster sidekick, Hoppy Uniatz. During the war, and in the years immediately after, the saint acts as federal agent and detective, pursuing Nazis and gangsters after the manner of Philip Marlowe. Finally, in the 1950s, we get the cosmopolitan saint, suave, sophisticated, solitary, endlessly globe-trotting and living in luxury hotels. But several things remained constant. The distinctive Stickman logo and the saint's whistled signature tune, both devised by Charteris. When The Saint came to films in 1938 in a highly profitable series produced by RKO Radio Pictures, it was in the person of the Anglo-American saint. Louis Haywood starred in the first film, The Saint in New York, and George Sanders took over for five subsequent films, becoming the face and voice of the saint for many people for many years.
Mr. Cullis is on his way here because he suspects that you filched a bundle of velvet from the home of a fellow malcreant named Eastman.
So what?
Mr. Cullis doesn't want a police investigation here. In fact, he'd much rather submit you to the coroner.
I think Sanders is good. He's a good saint of his time. He has that, like Roger Moore in the TV series, he has almost this throwaway part of his act. It's almost like he's a character that doesn't get involved, who is detached. And I think Sanders played that quite well. To tell you the truth, I'm not absolutely sure what Charteris thought. I don't think he was particularly enamoured with any of them. I think he wanted Cary Grant to play the role, and when that didn't happen, I think his interest waned.
I knew you were lying when you said you weren't with the police.
Oh, no, you didn't. You just weren't quite sure. And no matter how angry I make you, it's quite obvious you can't afford to have a shot heard from this house.
Mr. Tupper.
I'm very sorry, but under certain conditions, I simply can't resist the temptation to be a cad. I can see by this gentleman's manner that he's never kissed you, but would like to.
Get out of here.
I will. As you get to know me better, you'll realize that I have moments of almost maudlin sentimentality. Actually, we're quite a bit alike. You could never live without adventure, neither could I. You wouldn't understand that, would you, Mr. Brick?
No, I'm afraid not.
That's where our likeness ends, Mr. Templar. Perhaps I could forgive you for meddling here, but not what you said about my father.
You intend to do something drastic about it?
Let's just say that soon you'll be talked of in the past tense.
Good, I'll compose a nice obituary for myself. You won't keep me in suspense.
No.
Can I depend on that?
Completely.
Thank you.
The Saint made his radio debut in 1939 in a series starring Terence DiMarney and made by a commercial station, Radio Erin.
Terence DiMarney and his brother Derek were sort of suave and handsome matinee idols of their time. I think Derek DiMarney actually produced the original series with Terence acting as Simon Templar. They were very early, 1939, and I presume because of that they were probably quite true to the books. The following year, Terence repeated the role on the Forces radio when I think they got a wider appeal.
But the Saint's principal radio incarnation was in the United States, where between 1945 and 1951, his adventures were heard on various networks and voiced by a mixture of British and American actors. This was the Saint Mark IV, the New York-based private detective. In 1945, American radio and film actor Edgar Barrier played Simon Templar in a series of adaptations of Charteris stories, with Charteris himself as script supervisor. The second series of 26 Saint programmes, for some of which Charteris devised new Saint stories, starred the British actor Brian Ahern. But by far the longest run, 1947-50, was enjoyed by velvet-voiced Vincent Price.
Come in.
Mr. Templar?
Well, look what I get, and I didn't even send in any box tops.
What?
I was expecting Randy Patterson, but he can wait. In fact, I hope he does. Come in, come in.
Mr. Templar, you've got to help me.
Well, in that case, you'd better call me Simon.
He was a great radio saint. Once again, they cleaned up the character for radio. They made him urbane and witty, and Vincent Price played him with that same offhandedness that Jules Sanders brought to the role. They made him a bon vivant. Most of the adventures started in a restaurant or in some high-class drinking hole or a theatre preview party, when a screamer and a gunshot would suddenly bring the adventure to a fore. And Vincent Price's narration at the beginning, when he would just set up the story, was very laconic, and it was almost like it was, you know, life had been going on okay, and then this adventure interrupted his normal hedonistic lifestyle.
This Simon Templar encountered those staples of late 40s cinema, fugitive Nazis, crooked fight promoters, corporate swindlers, seedy nightclub owners, jewel thieves and mobsters. The stories invariably involved a damsel in distress.
Well, to what do I owe this?
Look, let me close the door. I've been followed.
Naturally, you're a blonde.
I assure you, the men who followed me weren't interested in the color of my hair.
Don't tell me they were chasing you for your money.
No, dear, not my money, my life. Well, it's good to be here, finally. I've come a long way to see you, Simon.
Well, if I'd known you were coming,
You didn't expect me?
You're as unexpected as Yankee bean soup on a menu in Moscow, but infinitely more welcome.
You weren't contacted? You didn't speak to Maxime?
The only Maxime I know happens to be a restaurant in Paris.
Oh.
There was frequently a femme fatale whose toils Simon would neatly sidestep.
Oh, Simon, if you help me, we'll be more than friends.
Aren't you forgetting just one small little item?
Am I? Now, don't tell me you're afraid of my husband.
No, Felice.
Then I don't understand.
I'm afraid of you.
But above all, Simon was solving crimes and detecting murderers.
It's a very charming house you have here, Mr. Hart.
What did you say?
I said you have a very charming house here.
My house?
Well, you didn't really think I was fooled, did you? That voice you heard in your club was a fiction. It had to be. Our trip here was planned by you, so that we'd be alone here.
Oh, why would I want that?
The better to kill me, my friend.
Kill you, you say?
That's what I say.
Why would I want to kill you?
And because, like yourself, I think that suicide note of Charlie's was a fake.
Oh, I never said...
I did. It is a fake.
How did you know?
The note ran to the effect that Charlie was committing suicide because the police suspected him of murdering Clark. But the police didn't suspect Clark of being murdered.
Well, perhaps not, but you did.
Yes, but Charlie didn't know that, Mr. Hartzell. I didn't tell him.
Very well. Just stay right where you are.
What a handsome revolver.
I did kill Charlie, so that there wouldn't be any investigation into Clark's death. I couldn't afford that.
If you kill me, there will be an investigation.
No, because no one knows you came here with me. You're not going to die. You're going to disappear.
Oh?
In my furnace.
I wouldn't like that. Too warm.
I'm afraid your lights can no longer be considered.
Well, in that case, I'll have a cigarette. Let me see now. Which pocket?
Hold on.
Oh, Mr. Hart, so do you want... Oh, my. You dropped your revolver. Now I have two.
You said you weren't armed.
I'm such a liar. But then, you see, I knew when you asked me why you asked me. So perhaps I'll be forgiven.
Templar, I killed Charlie, but... I didn't kill Clark. I swear I didn't.
Good heavens, Mr. Hartzell, I never for a moment thought you did.
When Price gave up the role, he was succeeded for the final 1950-51 series, first by American actor Barry Sullivan, and later British actor Tom Conway. Conway, with his distinctive clipped voice and suave manner, was the brother of cinematic saint George Sanders, and became virtually a one-man media detective industry, playing the Falcon, Bulldog Drummond and Norman Conquest on film, and Sherlock Holmes and the Saint on radio.
Feeling better, Mr. Templar?
Not as good as when I was unconscious.
It can be arranged, Dutch.
You had a better future when you were swinging through the trees.
That mean you're calling me an ape?
Throw him a banana.
Why? Oh,
Stanley!
Better not irritate him, Simon, darling. He's hot-headed.
And soon he'll be sitting in a chair that's going to make him hot all over.
The Saint reached television in 118 episodes between 1962 and 1969, initially using Charteris's original stories and later new stories by other writers. It proved equally popular in America as Britain and gave a fillip to sales of the Saint books, leading Charteris to write some new ones, often with collaborators. As part of Hollywood's current craze for refurbishing old television series on the big screen, there's been a new Saint film starring Val Kilmer, the erstwhile screen Batman. Dick Fiddy was distinctly unimpressed.
Personally, I think it was doomed from the moment that they decided to make it contemporary, despite the fact that perhaps the TV series had worked. Charteris was still writing at the time, and he'd already brought The Saint into the 50s and 60s, so there may have been an element of something for them to grab onto. But this Saint was... It was bizarre, actually, that they chose to call it The Saint, because it bore so little in common to the original character. Yes, he was a thief, but that was about... And his name was Simon Templar, but that was about the end of it. They tacked on a ludicrous backstory to explain his origins and to perhaps explain some of his present-day angst and his distrust of people, which did very little to shade in the character at all.
But once again, radio came to the rescue. In 1995, three superb radio adaptations of three of the pre-war Charteris novels were broadcast on the BBC. They were produced by Matthew Walters, and two of them were adapted by Neville Teller, who explained the concept behind the series.
The important thing from our point of view was to consider what we were going to do with the saint in bringing him to radio for the very first time, which is what we were up against in 1995. He never appeared on British radio before. I know he'd appeared on American radio, and of course there was the very, very famous TV series in the 60s. And the first problem that faced us was, were we going, as the TV series did, to update the stories to the current moment, make them contemporaneous, or were we going to try to recreate the feel and style of the period in which they were written? And on a logical analysis of the situation, we came to the view that in 1960, it was just possible to update those stories and make them credible. A Robin Hood of crime, a buccaneer, somebody who could actually operate in that sort of way was just conceivable still in 1960. We were only 20 or 30 years away from when the stories were actually written. But by the 1990s, to try to recreate such a character living in contemporary Britain would have been almost impossible, we thought. And so we went for the other option, which was proving extremely successful both on radio and in television, which was to lovingly recreate the feel, the atmosphere, the background of the original concept in radio terms. And so we went for the idea of presenting a saint in his own time to listeners.
Three cheers for our licensing laws.
I suppose you like being packed off to bed when the clock strikes 11.
But darling Patricia, just think. If it weren't for our professional nannies, we'd still be swilling inferior champagne and being deafened by saxophones in that revolting roadhouse.
If only.
Instead of reveling in the magnificent English countryside. You are reveling in the magnificent English countryside, aren't you?
I can't see any magnificent English countryside. It's pitch black out there.
Well, revel in the magnificent English country road, then. You can see that.
There is certainly a political element in a number of them. This is the point I think I was trying to make. The third one that I put on the air, The Saint Plays with Fire, deals with the rise of a fascist party in France. And the saint, of course, not only is dead against the people trying to establish this regime in France, but has a lot to say about Nazism and fascism in Germany and Italy at the time.
Oh, for some saxophones.
Miss Home wants saxophones. Saxophones Miss Home shall have.
And cuss them like vermin. Destroy them like rats who
would
carry their plague germs throughout our fair land. The blood of a million Frenchmen, dead on the field of glory, cries out to you. Show yourselves worthy of their sacrifice. Rise up and arm yourselves against this peril that threatens you from within. Sons of France, I call you to arms.
For heaven's sake, Simon, switch it off.
No, listen to it, Pat. It's the sound of a world gone mad. I've heard this sort of thing before. One night I was fiddling with the radio and caught some Nazi jamboree in Nuremberg. It's like an infectious disease, nation after nation falling over themselves to wipe out 2,000 years of civilization. First Russia, then Italy, Germany, Spain, and now France. Thank God for a little sanity. And English saxophones.
But what was that?
The Sons of France. Heard of them? Colonel Marteau's blue shirt gang. They've been holding a midnight rally outside Paris. Torches, bonfires, flags, bands. The whole shooting match lifted from Herr Hitler.
What's it all in aid of, for heaven's sake?
Overthrowing the French socialist government, probably. And leaving the world safe for the arms manufacturers to make an honest fortune out of mass murder. It's a lovely idea.
I thought it was very important for the radio series to establish a distinctive style. And the solution that I came up with, and the producer, Matthew Waters, went along with, was the idea of the plots flowing along on a sort of river of contemporary dance music, those sort of foxtrots and quick steps of the time. The feel we wanted was the glamorous 30s, the Cole Porter, Gershwin, Irving Berlin era, awash with dance music. Dance music was the thing. And so we decided that this was what we would do. We put away the concept of the little jingle of the television version, and we would bring back the dance music feel of the 1930s.
The Saint was played by Paul Rees, who looked and sounded just right.
He brought to the radio interpretation exactly the feel, in my view, that we wanted. That is, the insouciance, the debonair feel. But because there is, if you listen carefully, you'll find that underneath there is that slight Welsh tang. It's still there. And that is, in fact, what, to my mind, made the character on the air. It made him classless. It put him outside the total establishment, which the Saint always was.
So, good. 3.4 seconds to the lamppost. Finishing post. Then boom. 3 booms. And frantic bourgeois insects down there everywhere.
Should be an interesting spectacle.
Police?
No. Sad for you, isn't it?
Can't imagine why you might be expecting His Majesty's constabulary. Now, don't be willful, there's a good boy. Oris has never missed at this range.
So who are you?
There are those who call me the Saint.
And what do you want with me?
You are Mr. Golter of the Black Wolves, and I claim my £5. That's the form, isn't it?
I do not know the man.
Oh, do us a favour, will you?
Horace, you assured me. I shall stop £2.10 from your wages. But bad luck for you, beautiful. Looking so like a murderous anarchist.
As you say.
Innocently propping up a chimney stack, which just by happy chance overlooks Crown Prince Rudolf's progress to his Guildhall luncheon.
It might seem.
Well, I'll tell you what, sweetness. You pass your pineapples to me, one by one, eh? And leave the pins in.
And look sharp about it.
Oh, never makes a cricketer your anarchist, does he? Take your Uncle Simon's advice, Golter, old man. Don't go dropping Mills bombs about. They're liable to go off bang, you see. So, put them back in your pocket. That's a good boy.
Why this foolish conjuring game?
Reasons of my own. You aren't impressed?
5 minutes, sir.
So, we must be leaving you, Golter. Do you mind it terribly?
You are a madman.
Is that why you're afraid?
I do not fear you.
But you ought to, beautiful. You really ought.
Although Leslie Charteris died in 1993, it's clear that his character lives on. Not least on radio. The BBC's well-received 1995 series and the reissue of the Vincent Price series on audio cassette indicates that the Robin Hood of modern crime has firmly taken his place in the great gallery of fictional immortals permanently engaged in the battle against evil and injustice.
You've been listening to another transcribed adventure of the Saint, the Robin Hood of modern crime.
Radio Detectives was written and presented by Geoffrey Richards and produced by John Rolfe and Helen Williams.